This evening, we would like to talk and focus our attention on the subject of disasters. And as those of us on the teaching staff discussed this a little bit, we became aware that it's an awfully broad field, and we were much more concerned about how people can respond to this. What really evokes compassion, which is the Christian virtue which we would hope be the response to disasters. We'll talk about disasters within and without. And for example, the facet of the whole subject that concerns us a lot is just how compassion works in this. We use the term mercy, compassion, a great deal in the Christian vocabulary. And the panelists asked me to just say a word about one of the things that I have observed in my few years. It's sort of a fable or whatever, not a really happened sort of thing. But let's pretend for a moment that, well, you, Mrs. Young, that you came into the room this evening and sat exactly where you are, and I came tripping in here with a little child, pretty little child, fluffy little dress, little pigtails, bows in it, just as sweet as could be. But I'm leading her by the hand, and one by one you begin to perceive that the child is blind. And so I pick up the book and I say, "Helen, Mrs. Young is sitting right across the room from me. I'm wondering if you would take this and carry it to her. She's right across here." And so I lift her up here, and she begins her walk, and just as she does, I pick up a briefcase and put it in front of her, and she falls down into the sand here. And all of you people are just horribly offended at what I have done. And you all reach forward to pick her up, and someone gets her, and tears are just coming down her eyes. She isn't hurt, but she's frightened, and you all take her and you pass her on. And I tell you, what I did was entirely to call your attention to the fact that this young child is blind and needs a seeing eye dog, and unless she gets one, she's going to be stumbling over briefcases all her life. And you suddenly catch a message. If I had just told you, "I know a little girl who needs a seeing eye dog," I could get $5 out of each of you. But now at this point, it becomes much more personal. You remember her wet cheek against your cheek as we passed her around, and you comforted her. And I'm sure that when you hear the price of this, I have no idea what it costs, but it's in the thousands of dollars, you'd come through with a rather sizable gift. Probably many of you would give $50 or $100. And when you got back over to wherever you're staying here in the village, and you would tell the story to somebody else, they would be moved by it too. And if you were giving $100, they'd say, "Well, you know, I'll give $50 for this." And when you got back home from Holden and you told somebody else about it, or the person you told talked about it, they might give $25. And when they go to their church the following Sunday, they might give $10. And the following week, people who were there would tell it to a neighbor, they would give $5, and the next people would remember them in their prayers. The farther away you get from the briefcase, the less immediate the whole situation becomes, and our compassion sort of dwindles, although the case is just as bad. And so the other people are going to be talking about this now. Esther Men, who's been doing a marvelous job on Bible studies every morning, if you've been missing it, y'all come. Great sessions. And she's going to be presenting a biblical background for this discussion on disasters and what evokes our compassion. Winston Cabot is, his expertise field is medicine, and he's going to be bringing that perspective to this. Margaret Lovejoy has been working in the field of Red Cross services in the past and has been very close to disasters, and she's going to be speaking on it from that perspective. I'd like to start the discussion with you, Esther, and carry on.
Okay. I've been asked to talk about disasters and compassion in the Bible. And first of all, the thing that's really clear is that we have a compassionate God. And that's repeated over and over in all the stories, in both the Old and New Testament. We all know the stories, but just to remind us, when the slaves were crying out in Egypt, the compassionate God answered their prayers and brought them out, responded to their crisis, brought them into freedom. Or when the political prisoners in Babylonian exile were crying out, they were also heard by a compassionate God, and he brought them home. And when we go to the New Testament, there the story after story of Jesus in contact with people, healing the sick and performing exorcisms, feeding the hundreds and so forth. Every moment in his biography was a contact, and it seems that, you know, all of us present some kind of disaster and to which Jesus responded in those stories. It's really incredible. Then he also instructed the disciples and us through the disciples to follow a way of compassion and love for one another, to respond in that same kind of way, to feed and clothe and give drink and visit the sick and those in prison and so forth. And that was a way of life that he instructed people in. In fact, when the rich man asked him, you know, how to inherit the kingdom, he tells him finally, well, sell everything you have and give it away to the poor. Well, I certainly can't say that I've done that. In fact, I'm moving more towards tithing, you know, that kind of thing, as a response to disasters everywhere. But that is the way that Jesus instructed us to follow, to open our hearts to others that we're in contact with. It's interesting to me, there's a couple of passages in the New Testament where it seems that Jesus is overwhelmed by people too. He goes away to a quiet place because he and the disciples can't even eat anymore. It's as if the response to, a compassionate response to people's needs, you know, draws people more and more towards him, and eventually he can't even, you know, he needs to get away for a period. So the problem we have too, and when we start opening our hearts, it feels overwhelming at times, knowing, you know, where to begin and where to focus our energies. Another interesting quote that I remember is when the woman with the flask of perfume comes in and puts it on his feet, and the disciples say, you know, we could have made money and we could have solved some problems with this. So, you know, this is a waste. And Jesus says, well, the poor will be with you always. So the problem is really a vast problem, as pointed out by that. And I guess, in conclusion, we're challenged by the teachings of Jesus to open our hearts and to be compassionate to those that we come into contact with. But it's a difficult, difficult way that'll keep us busy for the rest of our lives.
Okay, thank you. When I introduced Winston before, I didn't mention he also is doing some lectures, and he's good too. So don't miss his sessions. Okay, would you carry on, Winston?
That kind of build up. I think I'm going to direct my remarks at a medical problem that I have the most familiarity with right now, and that is the crisis, the epidemic of AIDS that we're grappling with. I work with HIV-infected individuals as their doctor, and have a lot of contact with what they're going through in their lives. But I think, in a sense, what I'm going to say applies to just about any disease that one might grab out of our current human experience. I'm fortunate to live and to be working in a city where there is a good deal of overt acts and organizations of compassion available serving HIV-infected individuals. In Seattle, for example, 2 weeks, I think, from now, from this weekend, there's going to be a large walk to raise money for programs for AIDS patients. And if this year is like previous years, thousands of people will turn out to raise money in a sort of pledge for walking distance kind of event. There is several good charitable voluntary organizations that provide chore service and Meals on Wheels type service to debilitated AIDS patients. There is a recently opened hospice that is a wonderful facility for people to spend the last few months of their lives if they have HIV infection. And in reflecting upon all those things, some of which my patients have used and desperately needed and have found very helpful, and for which I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful that those resources are available for my patients. Reflecting upon those, though, at least in Seattle, I think one of the major motivations why so many individuals in Seattle are involved in that is sort of summarized in the word immediacy. In Seattle, a number of individuals, much of the population has friends or family members or at the very least acquaintances who have AIDS or HIV infection. And so to some extent, for a number of individuals in Seattle, that's an immediate problem. But I also know of individuals in Seattle who are, I think immediacy isn't enough for members of the church, for Christians. And I think, and I do know of Christians, of church members in Seattle, who are involved in these sort of activities who do not necessarily have those sort of personal contacts with HIV-infected individuals or with people who have AIDS. And so I wonder sort of what the motivation for those committed and involved individuals, those compassionate Christian individuals, who do not have that sort of immediate contact. And I think one way to summarize that kind of compassion is to say that those individuals are able to, they have eyes wide open and they're able to generate a personal sense of immediacy using to some degree the vision of their belief, of the gospel. To create a sense of immediacy that they would not otherwise have. And I think that that may be in some respects what compassion is for Christians or what it ought to be for Christians. There's one other level of compassion that I'm not sure how exactly to fit in, but I think the issue of justice also needs to tie in and to inform our understanding of Christian compassion. And perhaps the best example that I can give of that, to sort of continue this motif, is that there are a number of other countries where HIV is also a major problem. It's a major problem in the developing world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. And there, HIV infection is to a large degree tied in with socioeconomic factors, with poverty, with the lack of human rights, with oppression of women, with inability to maintain adequate nutrition. And I think that those call for a response, for a justice response from American Christians. That has to also inform our compassion. So.
Thank you. Margaret Lovejoy weaves in and out of village activities, but she really is responsible for all the neat programs that happen, and no blaming her if there's anything that isn't neat.
Don't happen.
Okay, Margaret, would you take over?
Well, I worked for the Red Cross for 7 years, both in volunteer management and administration. When I was out of the village this past week, since, you know, we don't always read papers when we're here, so I got a newspaper and I was just amazed at the hurricane that had hit Florida and all of the different accounts of what was going on. A couple years ago when I was with the Red Cross, it was when Hugo hit. And again, it was an outpouring of people and volunteers that wanted to go and help, which was very good to see, and my staff, they all wanted to go to help in the to volunteer, well, kind of paid, but volunteer. And, you know, a few days after that, the earthquake in California hit, so we really had two disasters going in both parts of the country at the same time. The phenomenon that came out of those two disasters was that people started earmarking their money where they wanted it to be used. And there was many more dollars earmarked for California. It was more of a glitzy disaster than the people in South Carolina and how they were suffering. And it was disturbing to see that it was probably, I think it came to like 20% more money for California than for South Carolina. And I wondered at that point, what makes people decide where they want to give their money? When I was reading about the in Florida, I also turned on the television and I saw this. I had read about these mounds of molding clothes that had been sent, a lot of winter clothes to Florida. I don't know why, but that's what they had. And people were looking for shorts and t-shirts going through the winter things that were there. But there was a scene of these neat little animal cages coming down a conveyor belt from an airplane. And they were shipping out the animals from Florida to New York to go to the Humane Society in New York. And the next shot was of people looking for garbage to eat. And it just boggled my mind that we would ship animals out and we wouldn't take care of the people there. So I wonder, where is our compassion in the time of major disasters? It's just one of those big wondering things that I have of how people respond.
Okay, you all have been bombarded. Esther and I, she, by the way, is serving with me as coordinator of the teaching staff for this summer, this summer's tail end, the last few weeks. We counted last year 123 appeals for help from charitable organizations. That means from different organizations. Some of them bombarded us every month and sometimes more frequently. And how do you begin to assess them? Most of them seem very, very important. And calling to mind and describing are very disastrous, either personal disasters or widespread disasters. I'm sure you probably have received a few pieces in the mail yourself. Let's pick it up from there, and now you people give your responses, if you will.
I found it a little bit interesting. We just came here today, so we did hear a little bit of the Florida disaster. And we heard an individual over the radio who was quite negative about the way the Red Cross handled the situation down there, in the way that the items that were needed were not being distributed. Not so much the complaint of the distribution, but rather the complaint that it wasn't getting distributed. But then that same individual went on to say that the military was supposed to be asked to go down there, but they were slow in going because a certain official officer did not get the word to move out. And it was interesting to hear the attitude of this individual on the radio who was complaining, well, it seems to me if he didn't receive a phone call, why didn't he call to get the word to move out? And so we found this individual that was complaining about the distribution or lack of it in Florida. Then a couple of days after that, I believe it was, Bush evidently had given an 800 number for Red Cross contributions. And what was the amount that had come in just a matter of relatively short time? It seemed like it was $2.5 million had been pledged to the Red Cross. And I don't know if all of this was earmarked to for Florida, but it was as a result of this. So the public really reacts in different ways. This one individual was quite negative, and my wife and I wondered, you know, I wonder how many people that hear that are going to say, you know, forget the Red Cross. And but then on the other hand, because of an 800 number was given, now there was an overwhelming support.
Appreciate your speaking up loudly so everybody hears. We all please do that too. Who else would have something to say?
Well, I think people need to have compassion on the people who are trying to help. That very often when the disaster strikes, it's so overwhelming that their volunteers, a lot of them are not professionals with the Red Cross. And in fact, nearly all of them are volunteers. So what happens is you're kind of learning as you go along because you're dealing with a lot of people who don't know how to do things. And you probably never, you know, meet with quite that kind of devastating kind of disaster. I think people just need to be kinder and help where they can, you know. But I tend to not be so compassionate as like when you talked about the girl that might need a seeing eye dog. Right away I think, well, you know, actually seeing eye dogs are free and you can get them, you just have to know how to channel it. Then the money you raise needs to send the child down there, and then once the child is there, they pay for all the room and board and the training if the child is of the age where they can, you know, take on a dog. And so that it's not really the cost of, you know, buying a dog and that kind of thing. It's the cost of sending the child to the location where the training goes on, where they train the child and the dog together.
Thank you very much. Next time I'll bring a whole bunch of little girls in here. Okay, thank you, though. That's helpful.
I don't
helpful.
Know if it's free everywhere, but I know the main school that we deal with in Oregon is this one in California. They are free, and in Oregon we raise a lot of the dogs because you have to train them for, you raise the puppy up to 6 months, and then they take over after that. They train the dog after that.
Thank you. I really was speaking out of inexperience here. That's helpful. Okay, back here.
I have a friend that works for the Forest Service, and her particular region does not have a sick leave bank. So she was saying that up on their computer comes the entire nation's individual disasters within a person's family, like somebody's daughter contracted leukemia and the mother has to go with the daughter and live somewhere and they need sick days. And so the people give, so the people through the entire United States will be giving their sick days to help this individual. And she was saying that it was just really, really moving all of their hearts. Every time they bring up the computer and they read about everybody's personal disasters, and they wanted to, and it wasn't their own sick leave that they gave away, it was their vacation leave that they would give to help. And she said they would come up and she'd read them, and she, oh, I want to give a sick day or a vacation day to this person. And you know, she said finally what happened is they just quit looking at their computer because somebody in their office ended out with a real tragedy, and nobody had any vacation leave to give to somebody right in their own office, so they stopped reading it.
Back there.
The space program has something, they say the astronauts or the space program has something called the Blue Book. The Blue Book is pre-thought-out procedures in case something goes wrong. They immediately can refer, this is what you do if this happens. Now, we're supposed to be a nation of intelligent people. Why does it take 4 days to send the Army in? We knew the hurricane was coming. We've had hurricanes before. Why don't we have a pre-thought-out plan that if it's a devastation to this degree, that the military is called out immediately? It takes more than, you know, volunteers. There's no jobs, no place to live, so you can't send a bunch of volunteers down there.
Okay, thank you. Next.
The one thing that I've often repeated about our church is that we know these things, as she said, are going to happen. But somehow or another, outside of Lutheran world relief, it seemed like we can't do anything until it happens. We ought to anticipate, you know good and well, for instance, how many tornadoes, there are hundreds of them, that are in the United States every year. But it seemed like we can't bring ourselves, we've got to first be shocked before we grab our pocketbook to help. You know, there's no seemingly way of getting people to anticipate.
Thank you.
I think one of the questions comes is how do we live with compassion in the midst of disaster? And you know something like the hurricane comes along and it gets media attention and we see it, or the earthquake in California comes and we see it. But you know, if we look into our consciousness, we also see that there are continuing daily disasters happening. The HIV crisis, the economics within our country, and poor people that set off. Things like the riot in Los Angeles, the state of Indian reservations, and unemployment and alcohol. There are a lot of these kind of continuing disasters that we somehow get hardened to, maybe, and. How do we keep our compassion alive?
We get dead to it.
Yeah, it's hard not to get dead into it.
Well, maybe if people knew about the small things in their neighborhood and they worked with it, then you develop skills so that you can do things that are bigger. Like with the Red Cross, you talk about all the disasters, but the only thing we have done and trained for, people's houses burned down in the neighborhood. You know, the Meals on Wheels go on all the time, and that has a lot of support because a lot of people like doing that. But like when you have a fire, you know, and you can, as church people, you can volunteer to work with the Red Cross. You go through their training program. They qualify you, and then you go on their alert, I guess, where you got the buzzer, and when they buzz you, you go, and you help take care of these people who have had a fire. Now, even if the person has good insurance and all kinds of things, when the home is devastated by fire, you know, they need support and help and care. And I think that's a good place for church people to be.
Good.
Right there in the neighborhood where you can help a neighbor because they're under duress, you know. And maybe that's what we need to do in our churches, is to help people understand where you can serve the community in a small way.
All right,
and the truth is, you may wait a long time before you get a chance to serve.
Thank you.
My wife and I are looking for a new house, and I'm surprised how many people are making fun of us, or fun of me at least, that we're looking in Tacoma, that we could look in Gig Harbor. And it's prejudice. It's just really terrible. I'm amazed that good Christian people, some in my family, who speak that way. My favorite story is a pastor in Tacoma who goes door by door at least twice a month for an hour and a half, just asking people. He happens to be a member of the Holden Board. It's Pastor Holly Plain from the Hilltop area, where we have drive-by shootouts. It's the most violent city in Washington right now. He goes door by door saying, "I'm Holly Plain from the Peace Lutheran Church. Is there anything I can do for you?" I don't know many church people who go door by door asking people if there's anything you can do for you. I just think it's a marvelous example. And I am following his example. I try to go and walk behind him at other doors, do the same thing for his church. I think it's a great example.
That's a tough one.
What kind of things does he do then for people? What's the
what do they say?
Anything under the sun. Mm-hmm. Could be money. And of course, he's been there 20 years. Mm-hmm. You can't put on. Then one fellow last week told me, he says, "Yeah, I need money." He says, "But you don't tell Pastor Plain that. He's going to laugh." He's been that way before. He knows how to work all of that stuff. Could be job. It could be getting over to the dock. It could be working with a landlord. It could be a whole bunch of stuff. And there are people in lovely homes there, and there are people in beat-up shacks and, you know, next to each other. So it's the whole thing. But he offers out. And then the only thing he says about the whole worship, he isn't trying to get members out of it. He says, "I hope you'll worship God." "I hope you'll worship God. If you don't have a place to worship God, you're invited to come to our house." But he puts the emphasis again on them, between them and God. It's a whole different approach that, at least, it's been new to me, and in my old years, I'm delighted to see it.
Do the people believe him?
I think you can tell right away. They believe him because he's been there 20 years. He's white. Most of the area is black and Asian. They believe him because he's there. Because he's there. Mm-hmm. And has not moved away. My guess.
Anyone else?
And that's a switch from visitors who come from the church who only want me to go to church. You know, mm-hmm. You're saying, "Is there something I can do to help you?"
Yeah.
Not, "Will you come to our church so we'll feel good because the pews are all filled up." Which is kind of what we do.
Well, that's an example of a church going out to the people rather than opening their doors expecting church to come to them. And I think that's what church, whatever church it is, has to do. It has to get out to the people.
One yes, sir.
The churches that has done more rescue and are equipped to come into an area and somehow or another they use their skills, talents, are the Mennonites. They're mm-hmm. supposed to be famous for that. They come in with saws, their chainsaws and so forth. The trees are falling down, cut things up, and they know they're not in there to proselyte. They just are in there to show their compassion for what's happened, as they are compassionate people. And somehow or another, I don't know, we don't have much training like that in our churches as far as if disaster strikes, and we get people to go say, maybe not be the next town near us, what could we do? I mean, we usually want to do everything with money, but maybe that isn't what's so immediately to do. Somehow or another use whatever talents we have.
Now, what is the question?
What is it that evokes compassion when you're confronted by disasters within and without? In other words, the personal, the small ones, the individual ones, as well as the big ones, the close ones next door when your neighbor's house burns down, or the starving people in Somaliland?
It should be Jesus Christ showing through our lives.
Comments?
I think for a while, our churches started feeding, taking care of the homeless. Like in the wintertime, it gets kind of cold in the Northwest, and the churches opened up their building to let these people sleep in them at night. And they took turns feeding the, you know, like one church would be open for this time, another church would be open as a shelter for the homeless.
Okay, what did you wish to say, ma'am?
I think for a long time there have been government programs of some sort to provide for people, and so I worked as a social worker for a time for the county of San Bernardino in California. And we got many, many calls from people telling us about problems, but it was not that the people making the calls were doing anything themselves to do something about it, other than to alert an agency to get involved. I think that many of us tend to depend on this.
Comment, sir.
I think our problem is that we live in a global village, and therefore we're confronted with disasters everywhere all the time. Now, certainly the media are very selective, and we hear very little about Southern Africa unless we're looking for it. We really have to dig for that if we want to know about Southern Africa. And there are lots of other disasters that are taking place all the time. And if we are looking for it, if we are alert to it, we're just on the brink of being overwhelmed. What comes in the mail, as well as what comes in television, and radio, and so on, seems to me that within church, what evokes compassion is some sense that's being conveyed to the people that there's a plan. Whether the, let's say it's a large congregation, perhaps the congregation will respond to some international disaster one month, and the other month it's a domestic disaster. But the sense that there's some kind of plan, and that we as church members aren't just going to be overwhelmed at church like we are at a mailbox every day with chaos. And we're all on the brink of chaos all the time. Increasingly, it seems to me. The numbers of people that are starving are increasing all the time. That's the nature of the world in which we live. And it's the selectivity that's such a challenge to us, that we're going to have to decide to do this and therefore not to do that. That's really tough.
Thank you. I see it. There was another hand up somewhere.
Right here.
Okay.
Well, you know, I kind of wonder sometimes, I mean, whether indeed we're, or I'm, as overwhelmed as I sometimes, you know, feel like I, as I sometimes claim. It's clear to me that there's strong potential there for being overwhelmed, but I have to honestly challenge myself, you know, how often do I ever actually reach that point? Esther's reflections about Jesus's ministry, one thing that struck me was that, you know, in all of the service that he did, he only really had to go off by himself a couple times. You know, and I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever reached that exactly yet. You know, I mean, in a sense, I think I perhaps have, but you know, that kind of crushing weight of being overwhelmed, despite the fact that I live in a global village and that you know, the impact, the potential impact of that is overwhelming. I'm not sure that I am that often. I don't think that most of us, even as Christians, stretch our compassion that far. And maybe one of the solutions to how to get stretched to that is what Elmer and a couple other people were suggesting, sort of the equivalent of think globally but act locally. Maybe, you know, sort of to be compassionate globally, you need to be compassionate locally and allow that to get pushed.
Instead of sending a check to my food bank in my neighborhood, for the last couple of months, I've taken the initiative to take it there rather than sending it by mail. And your check seems to, you want to make it bigger when you get there and you see the people that are using the food shop.
As an outsider looking at it, I think if you really care, you would be out there on the front lines. This is a retreat place where you come for strength, for growth, for, you know, whatever you call it, development. But for you to really do the job, you got to be out there in the trenches. And if you're hiding up here in the mountaintop, watch me trip over myself, you really can't do very much for the people out there, because you're not there where the needs are there every day, and you're not there to give the help. You have to live among the people the way Jesus went in order for you to be very helpful to them. Now, I'm not saying you should have a retreat center, but you need to understand that that's what it is. You can develop a really nice community here, and, you know, you're doing it among all these nice Christians, so if you're kind to them, they're kind to you. And, you know, it's really a nice life. In fact, I meet that and I say, hey, you know, I could do that for a year or so. But I think if you really want to help people, you got to be out there where they are. You can't help everyone.
Thank you. Back there in the corner.
I was just going to say, Cora Ten Boom in her book, The Hiding Place, said that we Americans have the tendency to want to write a check for everything. And I've pondered that a lot through the years. But let me tell you about my dilemma. I had a secondhand store. Now, I'm willing to help people that are burned out. They come to me, but I've been taken so many times until you get a tendency to be distrustful. I had a person come to me and just, I was willing to just almost empty my pocketbook. And I went home, and my daughter, who was a probation officer, happened to be there. She said, Mother, what was the name? And I said, and she said, that's the biggest cocaine user we have in town. So they're trying to sell their stuff to me in order to get money for drugs. So I usually have a gut feeling, but I found out that I thought I could always tell a drug user, and I found out that I can't. Okay. If they're shooting up in their arms, you can look for marks.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I think we should also realize the resources in our community, and even, for instance, the two insurance companies. The Lutheran insurance companies will match. They'll match your funds as far as helping in disaster. I think they've done a lot of that in Florida. We were in a church Sunday in Chillon, at the Chillon over here, the Lutheran church, and that pastor announced to the congregation that whatever they gave would be matched by Lutheran Brotherhood, or AAL, either one. I realize it sounds like a commercial for them,
but at any rate, it's good.
Yeah. I'm proud of the very fact is a policy holder that they do that. I think it's good. Mm-hmm. And every community ought to have in their Chamber of Commerce, in their brochures, what resources they have for disaster. And I never see anything like that in there. In case something happens, what are you going to do? And for the next community, how they're equipped to help.
Yes, ma'am.
The thing that evoked compassion lately was the picture of the babies that were shot on that bus when they were trying to bring them out of the country. That evoked compassion. And they had tremendous response. And that's what it takes to evoke compassion. It is a horrible disaster. it's not the normal everyday thing.
Comment.
See in the media.
That's exactly true.
And that's, I don't like to be quite there yet. Yeah. I don't know that we have any choice.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
To me, that brings about revulsion.
Okay, let's finish
well,
it.
I'm just going to say that when I was teaching psychology, that this book listed some of the factors we've been asking sometimes what makes it or what pushed people. If the victim has the appearance of trying to help himself or herself, people are much more willing to help. Mm-hmm. And the number of people present has a major effect. If there's a large body of people present and somebody's on the floor and somebody walks in the door, the person walking in the door is much less likely to offer help because there have been so many people there looking the situation over already. A large number of people present will make a newcomer much less likely to volunteer. These studies also found that blacks are more willing to help than whites, more likely to help than whites. Males are more likely to help than females, and that might be because a female is more often at risk. The cost of her helping might be higher if she'd be at risk. It seems to me that that our own priorities are very much involved here. I think most of us would rather teach a person how to fish than to give them a fish, because that way we give them a way to become self-sufficient. And this is essentially what we're doing with our own children. We're teaching our own children to be independent of us. And I think we have to husband our resources and say, well, to what degree can I be effective in helping this? We've pointed out, you know, the poor you always have with you, you know, and you mentioned the political, socioeconomic problems, Central America and maybe in Africa too. And in a sense, you know, if we cannot intervene in the political, socioeconomic situation down there, we send money or we send food and the government will intercept it and sell this food to whomever they want, to the highest bidder perhaps. So we cannot, as a government, control how to get food there. And even if we could, then we have problems like we feed 1,000 starving people and feed them very well for a generation, and we're going to have 10,000 starving people there. And, you know, without any question about population. This is a political issue, and as well as perhaps a moral issue, but it's going to be very difficult to send money long distances. I've been impressed with Holden here. Holden needs money, you know, and here Holden is doing its share of giving as an institution, and that impressed me, you know, when I was looking at the kiosk up there. And the but it seems that we have to do some token amount of giving at a distance where we can't control it very well. But I think we're all going to give much more heavily, locally, where we can control it and see how it's being used and manage the money so that we can do it the type of good so that the person becomes actually more independent and competent and able to take care of themselves.
Thank you. Are there some now who haven't spoken at all who'd like to say something? I don't mean to cut down anybody who has spoken, but if you've got anything in your mind, don't be shy. Let's hear what you have to say. Yes, sir.
I'd like to say that I think that it's good to be moved by compassion, but I think it's a wrong motivator. The gentleman in front of me said, well, we have a disaster, about the only ones who are ready to respond with some word of relief. Well, they don't respond with what they had left from the last disaster. They respond to people who act because Jesus said, love your neighbor. And they give systematically and constantly. And that's where the Lutheran World Hunger, Lutheran World Relief, Lutheran World Federation, they get their money from the people who take Jesus' work serious and don't wait to be persuaded by it. The media.
That's true. There were some people from Lutheran World Relief on the scene right away before the congregation, because some people had anticipated. So very, very good point. Yes, sir.
Would just make the comment that I think ties in here is that you know, been a couple comments about media and how we are at the mercy of the media. One of the things that we can do is pick the media that we read, and there is a lot of alternative media that gives very good information. The denominational sources, I assume the Lutherans do it, but I know the American Baptist and the Disciples do it. Church World Service does it, giving a broad view. In terms of knowing how to respond, having that trust within the Christian community, and using our denominational resources has for years impressed me as being the best stewardship of the dollar available, and being I can't be out there on the scene judging what needs to be addressed worst, but there are people on the national scene who are, and by trusting those people within our denominations, within ecumenical organizations like Church World Service, can really make our dollars go a long way and make it happen responsibly.
Okay.
I want to say amen to that. I think that's really making use of the network potential of the denominational structure, particularly by personalizing disaster. Again, to use that word, by personalizing it, knowing that one of our people is there, and building on that relationship with somebody we know and trust and love, who's giving us a firsthand account. The example that comes to my mind is I'm not a Lutheran, but the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador has taken on the mantle of moral leadership in that country. He's doing tremendous things with almost nothing, and is a beacon of hope through those struggling tiny little Lutheran congregations, any one of which could be linked with any one of our churches, Lutheran or not. And that's very, very powerful, because it's very immediate, and you can get letters or send delegations to meet real people.
Okay, did you have your hand up back there? I guess not. Okay, anyone else?
Okay. I'd like to say a word for the Catholics. The Knights of Columbus, their job is to go to disasters, and they are all over, and they do. And they supply food and clothes and lodging and all the things, and they have the reserve all the time, and they do it. Very active in Seattle and in all the small towns. Every Catholic church has that organization, Knights of Columbus. The one thing that's really happening right now is Church Women United. And those women are serving meals, some of them daily, and they are Church Women United, and they're working together, and that's all the churches. And in Auburn and Kent, it's very active, and it's a tremendous organization, and that's all given freely, helping people.
Elmer Witt.
The other side of the denominational point is by the headline I read once that no Lutherans hurt in tornado.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we were commenting in this in our planning for this evening that there's the churches have done a marvelous job.
Right.
I mean, Lutherans have started Lutheran Homes for the Aged, Lutheran Children's Society, Lutheran Hospitals, the Roman Catholics have done that, the Presbyterian. And there's something that the passage of, as we have therefore opportunity to to do good, let us do good, especially to the household of God. And the scripture says, let us do good to all people, and then it adds, especially to people. But if you sit on the especially to the people of God, that usually means Lutheran or Methodist or whatever club you belong to. Comment.
Well, I wonder how many have been tested for the bone marrow thing, the bone marrow bank, because you can save the life of many people.
And you can ask the same question about how many of you will the organs of your body upon your death?
Your blood. Donate blood.
And
well, actually, you just give them a tube of blood and they test it, and they give you all the factors that are involved, and if they match up, then... That's the scary part. Then you go for more testing, and then if you match up right, you actually donate the marrow, which means that you have to be in a hospital for
surgery.
A short time, and there's a little bit of pain, that kind of thing. But there are just so many things that can be done if people want to do, and initially it doesn't cost you very much. You know, one tube of blood.
We have only a few minutes left. I would just like to pose a question. I assume that one of your interests in coming tonight is because compassion is important to you. And I think the next question is, how do we control our compassion? I hear a lot of comments about that tonight. Don't let your compassion run away with you so that, you know. Sir.
Getting back to what Sven was saying earlier, I think that one has to be disciplined about it. It isn't just that you respond to a gruesome picture in a magazine or a newspaper and then give everything you've got and who knows who gets a hold of it. Or maybe it does some good, but I do think that, well, the neighborhood we live in, on the south side of Chicago, you are confronted with disaster all the time. I mean, it isn't as though you... There were some people here on teaching staff last week, a couple, and a woman works, Karen's works in a shelter for homeless women and their infants, or homeless women who are about to have infants, and they have infants on the street and in alleys in the south side of Chicago. And that's not very far from where we live, and we happen to be a little bit surrounded by an affluent neighborhood, but it bleeds in. I mean, we see this stuff all the time, and unless you set up, I believe, unless you set up a discipline for yourself, like my university sets up a program where I have deducted from my check every month a certain amount of money that's given to social services for our area, and you can't, I think it's possible to get overwhelmed when you see this around you all the time and feel just terrible, and then you figure, what is the use? And then you just stop entirely. Yeah. And the fact is, you're not going to solve all the problems or even half of them. But if you are disciplined in your giving, disciplined in your attentions, somebody is helped by it. Something good happens. We 2 weeks ago we had a forum where we were talking about, well, which organizations are the best ones to give your money to. I think it's important for me, and probably for all of us, to be disciplined about finding out where's the best, which letters we should respond to of the 150 per week that arrive in your mailbox. And, you know, do some study or have a group within the church or the community, find out which of the ones that really will make the best use of the money you sent them, and then be disciplined about that. I know people in our area who regularly serve as volunteers at soup kitchens or at the Ronald McDonald House, which is for the families of disaster people that are in the hospital and so forth. And they just do this as a regular thing, once every week or once every 2 weeks. There are plenty of people they don't serve. We're all sorry we can't serve everybody, but if we get into the habit, instead of just going, oh, do something, I think in the long run we accomplish more.
I'd like to just sneak into her territory for a moment and to catch on to the magnificent picture that Scripture has of the body of Christ, where different members are skilled, members of a human body are skilled to do certain things. My feet do very poorly with the piano. My hands do a little better. But there are different people in different circumstances with different skills that can really, really function together. But it's a matter of collaborating. And it's a matter also of, as St. Paul urges, have the mind of Christ, you know. We think Christ's way, and it's a selfless way, but then recognize the great gift that we have in being members one of another. It's been great being with you tonight. I wish you a very pleasant night.
Thank you.